This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Anita Rani, and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4.
Good morning. We are still reeling today as Sarah Everard's murderer starts his whole life sentence, the first ever given to a police officer, which means he'll never be released. With the thought of Sabina Nessa in our minds and thinking about the 80 women who have been killed in between their two tragic deaths. From the messages we've been receiving from you on social media, we know that many of you are experiencing a huge amount of emotion, anger, sadness, and fear. So today I'm asking you all, do you feel safe? And what needs to change in order for you to feel safe? I'm going to be joined by the Victims Commissioner, Dame Vera Baird, in a moment and can put your questions to her. It's her job to ensure that victims and witnesses of crime are listened to and to promote good practice across criminal justice services. So I'll ask you again, what will make you feel safe? Get in touch with us. You can text us on 84844. Text will be charged at your standard message rate, and do check with your network provider for extra costs. You can contact us via social media. It's at BBC Woman's Hour, or you can email us through our website. And it's a packed show today, full of women with incredible stories and talent to share, including Gnarly and Nikita Gill. They're a band who are performing at the South Bank Centre, but are probably unlike any band you've ever heard before, bringing together Nikita's poetry and Gnarly's two-fingered percussion. Have a listen.
A hymn for the women who have learned survival when survival was hell-bent on disavowing them. Praise for the women who face their own deaths to get here. Praise for the little girls who survived trauma early and refuse to let themselves be baptized tragically.
So we will be treated to a live performance during the show today. Writer Liz Fraser will be joining me to talk about her powerful and brave new memoir about being in a relationship and having a child with an alcoholic. And today, we are also discussing friendship, but a particular kind of friendship, intergenerational friendship. Do you have a mate who's either much older or much younger than you? And what makes this relationship in your life special? What do you think you get out of it? And what makes you get on? Is it important to be friends with people from different walks of life and age groups? And what does this friendship offer you that others don't? I would love to hear from you on everything we are talking about this morning. Text number is 84844. I'll be reading out as many of your messages as I can throughout the show. You can email by going to our website. And of course, you can go to our social media. It's at BBC Woman's Hour. But first, the Metropolitan Police Commissioner has said Sarah Everard's murder has brought shame on the force, admitting a precious bond of trust has been damaged. Dame Cressida Dick was heckled by people calling for her resignation outside the Old Bailey on Thursday after ex-PC Wayne Cousins was handed a whole life term. That call for her resignation has been echoed by a number of MPs and campaign groups. So where do we go from here? Have you lost faith in the police? What do you think needs to change? What measures would you like to see put in place to support victims and their families? And I'll ask you once more, what will make you feel safe? I'm joined now by Dame Vera Baird, the Victims Commissioner for England and Wales. As VC, it's Vera's job to support the rights and protection of victims of crime. Very good morning to you, Vera. Welcome to Woman's Hour. I'm going to start by asking you the question everybody's talking about. It's on all the papers. Where do you stand? Should the commissioner go?
I truly don't think that that's something that the victims commissioner should be expressing a view about.
So you don't have an opinion either way?
I certainly do have an opinion.
But you're not going to share it with
but
us?
I feel that it's not for me to express that view. Supposing I say one thing and say she goes, then the next time a victim's not treated well, they will say perhaps, well, you know, should the Victims Commissioner really have talked about the Metropolitan Police? No wonder they're not doing a good job because she got rid of their leader last time. And if I say she should stay, you know, the opposite will be the case. My interest is victims. My responsibility is victims. There is no doubt whatsoever that particularly females, victims' faith in the police has collapsed. But this is the pinnacle of it. This is the worst bit of it. It is dreadful that this was a police officer. Believe you, we did a survey a year ago which showed that only 5% of rape complainants thought they could get justice by going to the police then. So this collapse is at its worst and its highest now, but it is not a new thing. There is really very little faith by women in how the police deal with violence against women and girls. And frankly, you know, scrapping one individual in the hope that, you know, Superman is waiting in the wings and can put it all right is not a very realistic.
I should say that we have, of course, reached out to Cressida Dick to join us this morning, and she did decline the offer. In that case, Vera, I'll ask you what you think about the way the Met Police have reacted, how they've reacted to what's happening. Is it satisfactory in your view?
No. I think that, firstly, I'm very pleased if they think that they can put forward a positive strategy that will impress people. Let's give them that opportunity. But honestly, you know, another piece of paper that we can put on the shelf isn't going to make the difference. It has been very clear for a very long time. Look at the figures you've already quoted, Anita. You know, it's 80 women who've been killed since Sabina, since Sarah, including Sabina. And all of the outcry that there was around Sarah's death, you know, 180,000 women wrote to the government's violence against women and strategy. The Inspectorate of Constabulary, I think you had Zoe Billingham on yesterday.
Yes, we did, yeah.
She led that brilliant report. Well done to the Home Secretary for commissioning that in-depth look at the police. It concluded there is an epidemic of violence against women, girls, and the police have failed to protect them against it. They've got better. I'm in no doubt they've got better over the last decades, but it's extraordinarily patchy. And, you know, one has to look at the real problem that probably innate sexism runs through the police, probably more deeply than it runs through society, though it remains a big factor in society. Attitudes that women are, you know, not so valued for anything but their sexuality. And so they are not treated as people.
Why do you say that, Vera?
I mean, this is just my, you know, sort of cheap assessment from, you know, from my own experience. Isn't the fact that in society now, there is a permissive quality to the fact that women are seen primarily as sexual creatures, not wholly as sexual creatures, but they are, I still think, seen in that fashion. That's the first.
But you've just said you think you just said that you think it's worse in the police than in society. Why did you say that?
If that was you, well, I think that it's probably the nature of policing. First of all, it's still very male. And even though there are some women chief constables, there are obviously not enough. There is no critical mass of female officers to change the culture. The culture remains male dominated. I have heard people say that, you know, you can be gay, you can be black, you can be a woman, but actually that's all fine in the police as long as you behave like a straight white male. There is a need for a sense of collegiate nature about the police because they have to deal with public order stuff. They have to know they can rely on each other. But that can tend to bond into a sort of brotherhood. And I say that probably another reason that it's worse in the police is because of the nature of why people go into policing. Quite often it's a bit of an action man thing, not quite military, but not far off it. And that's the stuff they're interested in. A senior woman police officer said to me just a few weeks ago, if it's a burglary, boy, they'll go very, very quickly, speaking of the police. If it's domestic abuse, they probably won't hurry quite so much. So I am obviously very worried about the whole history of this.
And we're
not getting violence against women and girls any nearer the top of the priorities than they were when I was a young woman.
Our listeners, hearing you say that, who are already feeling all the emotions that I mentioned in the opener, they're angry, they're sad, they're terrified. And we know this because they're getting in touch with us to tell us how they're feeling. Listening to you say that, as someone who was, before you were victims commissioner, you were police and crime commissioner, so you know what's going on. How is that going to feel that they can trust the police, which is a conversation that's going on more widely? How can women possibly trust the police if they've just heard you say that?
I'm sorry, you know, they don't trust the police and they haven't been doing for some time. And I reflect, you know, it isn't what Vera Baird thinks. Obviously, there is my own experience and obviously it is my own experience that's speaking to. But we have, you know, a fantastic stakeholder network where we make sure that when a position needs to be taken about victims, it's not mine, it's what I've been told by victims. And you couldn't say it more loudly this morning than victims themselves and female members of the public themselves are saying. Trust in the police has currently been lost, but it isn't, as I think the Met are trying to make it seem, only this awful incident that's caused that loss. The police have not been as good as they should have been dealing with violence against women and girls for a very long time. Mm. And so innate distrust has simply built up. My message is to the police, surely at this stage, you must realise how deficient your service to women has been. This, you know, awful crescendo must tell you now's the moment. You really have got to raise this as a national priority. And I think Zoe Billingham yesterday was saying, well, I fundamentally agree, which is violence against women and girls has to become a national strategic policing requirement on every force. Then it can have more resource. Then the forces which are doing quite good work, that good practice will be spread to other forces and not resisted. There will be an expertise that is valued, that has status. So people will want to go into this area of investigation and policing. And we need through police channels to lift up its priority. And I think that's the way to start doing it.
Do we trust?
I can finish that tiny sentence and then back to you with apologies for taking so long.
No, take your time.
I think if you say to police, you know, your sex is changing, that isn't going to make the difference. I think if you can say you're failing as police officers, this is half of the population. And the way to do that is to use a police definition and drive it through the police own channels. So I'm 100% with Zoe Billingham about the likeliest way of making relatively speedy change. That's not to say we don't have to tackle societal attitudes as well.
Do we trust the police to police themselves on this?
Well, again, they haven't, it seems, been doing that well either. I mean, this guy who, you know, is just beyond words, should not have got as far as he is.
Yeah.
But I think you saw some data probably came out yesterday from Byline Times, who've done some Freedom of Information requests of 83, I think it is, officers in the Met who did some sort of sexual misconduct in the last 4 years. 40-odd of them are still in post. And that wasn't only, though this is bad enough, sexual misconduct with other officers. It was on occasion sexual misconduct with vulnerable victims and witnesses. So you have the idea, you know, somebody who's themselves been abused, perhaps, and wants the help of the police, knowing that somewhere in there, there is a cohort of men who have themselves been guilty of sexual misconduct. And I think we know that 700 officers in policing more broadly, not just in the Met, have been reported and have been found to have been guilty of domestic abuse. And the prosecution rate there is even tinier than it is in the public domain. So it is hard to feel confident that they have acknowledged that there is a problem of their own abuse internally and have tackled it sufficiently, which again is bound to sap the confidence of people externally who want to come to them for support. None of this is not to say that there aren't some excellent officers and a very large number of those. But this inherent problem has been around for so long. This has got to be the moment action's taken.
As you can imagine, Vera, we're getting lots of people getting in touch with the programme. 84844, by the way, is the number to text. An email from someone who wants to remain anonymous says, I'm a woman in my 80s and I worry for my daughter and granddaughter. There are no doubt many good and honest policemen. However, the police should be checked regularly, their personalities, their phones, their domestic behaviour. And there's only a third of women police officers, and that should be at least 50%. This dreadful man was known apparently as the rapist to his colleagues. So why was that allowed to continue and end in this truly dreadful death? He is not the only one who is guilty, but those colleagues too.
Well, that's why, apart from the fact that confidence was, as my survey showed, and it's obviously not the only one, go back to Zoe Billingham, you know, who found that asking the four forces she selected as sample forces to identify the 10 most men who were most dangerous to women. She got them to do that, but 34 of them hadn't been identified before. That's to say, you know, almost 7/8 of them hadn't been identified as dangerous to women before. They only did it because they were driven by the inspectors. That means the police are not protecting women against them. They are not dealing with them in the way that they deal with perpetrators of other offences. When they do manage them in the community, they do make it harder for them to offend. So it's, you know, that's all in the background here. And it can't be that one says, you know, chop this person's head off, introduce a new set of rules about officers in plain clothes, draft a strategy 6 months down the street and it's all sorted. There has to be action now. I do think Zoe Billingham hit the button, and I do think we need the government to take a serious interest in it too.
Vera, what I need to ask you though, as someone who has spent your entire career fighting for reform, you know, you're a barrister for 25 years. In 2009, you sat with the Stern Review, which looked at the way rape cases are handled, and you concluded then that the focus needs to be in victims. That was 2009. Your entire career working at the highest level to try and implement change, and yet here we are, and women are tired, they're devastated, they're angry, they're scared, they can't trust the institutions put in place to protect them. Enough is enough. Enough talk, surely. Enough reviews. When are we going to see action? When are we going to see change?
There has to be action immediately. I'm afraid the burden falls to some extent on the Home Secretary and she has to grasp it. I do think elevating this to a strategic national priority is the way to open the door to a real understanding that it's got to be tackled properly by policing. There is a much broader societal problem that I tried to kind of describe in my own woolly terms in the beginning, which also needs tackling, because it is important. You know, if women's voices could get rid of violence against women and girls, it would have gone, as you say, 30 years ago. We need to mobilise the whole of society, and particularly men. Now, violent men are very different from ordinary men, and there is no question of blaming all men for any of this at all. But what we need to do is we need to get to a stage where when a man catcalls a woman in the street or wolf whistles, frankly, you know, that isn't going to make her feel that she's very pretty and she's very lucky to have that admirer. It's going to make her think, you know, which predatory bloke is that? Is he coming down off where he is to come and have a go at me? You know, men and women need to say to people who do that, just stop, just don't do it. Because if you don't stop sexist behaviour against women at the start, then there is a sort of sense of permission for it to go forward. And men who are violent will take that permission and will go from bad to worse. You've seen what happened. This guy, one day he is indecently exposing himself. The police do not deal with that. Yeah. Nobody in his colleagues stops him and says, that is very, very bad. The red flag that should have been flown by that is not seen by anybody. And a few days later, we have the horror that there's been. These things can escalate extremely badly. And it needs to be acknowledged that this kind of casual sexism is a permissive element which allows bad men to do bad things.
And that conversation is happening nationwide, and it's happening a lot on social media, particularly coming through to us at Women's Hour. By the way, it's at BBC Women's Hour. As the Victims Commissioner, Vera, I must ask you, what lots of us are, you know, really feeling a wave of emotion, and particularly for the families of both Sabine Nessa and Sarah Everard. What support is there for those families at this point, for the victims of the families?
So a family of somebody who bereaved by crime will be entitled in policing to a family liaison officer who is, as is often said at these times, a specially trained person in whom, I have to say, many victims put a lot of faith and have a lot of praise for. They're there to liaise between the family and the investigation. So the family is kept up to date about the investigation, but they also have a responsibility for the broader welfare of the family. You have to remember that victims, by and large, are not at the centre of criminal cases. A big mission of mine is to put victims at the centre of criminal cases. But at the moment, obviously, they're pursuing the prosecution. But the FLO's specific task is to keep the family involved and to ensure that their welfare needs are met. There is also the National Homicide Service, which is not run by the police. It's run by Victim Support, which is a separate charity, and is nationally commissioned by the Ministry of Justice. It is very experienced. It has access to specialist kinds of homicide supporters who have experience of all. I mean, for instance, one that I'm very familiar with is domestic abuse, people who are specialists in the domestic abuse bereavement. So that kind of service, which is victim support type service, is readily available to families in this situation. And then, you know, there are specialist bereavement organisations. There is the statutory services in due course. But that's the sort of threshold support that will be there at the moment for this family.
And I'm sure we will be talking about the support and that is available to victims of various crimes at some point in Women's Hour. But for now, Dame Vera Bird, thank you very much for joining us and speaking to me this morning. 84844 is the number to text. Someone has messaged and says, a teacher of teenage girls, I have no idea how to reassure my students about the police protection and where to even point them to when I've lost faith. That's from Sarah in London. You can also contact us via social media or email via our website. Now, Irish Indian poet and writer Nikita Gill and British Sri Lankan producer and live performer Nali are set to perform together for two nights at the Purcell Room in the South Bank Centre in London tonight and next week. In this new collaboration, Nikita writes poems, which are then transformed with electronic music into songs by Nali. And they join me now in the studio, actually physically present in the studio to talk to me and to perform. Have I described it right, Nali? You're basically collaborating to do something completely new.
It's definitely something very new. I don't think it's ever been done before.
Well, that's exciting. And so this is the first on Woman's Hour. Describe yourself as a duo, Nikita. What is it?
I think what we are a band. And what we are doing is like a collaboration of literature, art, music, and also visuals. Like, so it's an experience. I would definitely call it that. But yeah.
And you've both come from two very backgrounds. Nali, you're a producer, music producer. And a creative generally. You do lots of various things, I'll let you tell me. And Nikita, you're a writer. You've published lots of books. You're also an illustrator. So how did you come together?
So it was through Noam and Anushka Shankar. Anushka had a festival at South Bank a couple months back for like the reunion of events starting to happen after lockdown again. And they had this idea to kind of combine us and see what we could come up with.
Anushka Shankar is in the sitar player. Anushka Shankar was brought you together. That's quite a good origin story, isn't it, of collaboration. So tell us about the work itself, Nikita. Your work features women heavily.
Oh, yes. The show specifically makes space for women's rage. And it makes space for women's rage with an intersection of mythology meeting the modern woman. And I think what's really cool about it is Nali just every time with every poem just understands the assignment. She gets it spot on first go. And that's why I think this collaboration works so well, because she's so talented and I feel so privileged to be working with her.
So you've written poetry specifically about women, and Nali, you're putting the music to it.
Exactly, yeah.
It's very timely, isn't it, Nikita? Mm-hmm. We've just the conversation that we've been having over the last few months, particularly on Women's Hour, we've just been talking to the Victims Commissioner there. Women are feeling a lot of rage, mm-hmm. as well as sadness and anger, but rage is something that they're feeling right now.
Yeah, precisely. I think the other thing is there aren't a lot of spaces for women's rage. The minute we express it, there are so many words that are used to like shut us down. And I want to make space for that. I think it's incredibly healing to feel that rage and to feel that grief in full instead of suppressing it. And that's what this show is about.
Is it important? I described you both. You've got this amazing various cultures coming into the room right now. So I described you as an Irish Indian poet, Nikita, and that you're a British Sri Lankan producer. Is it the fact that you're women of colour, is that important to the work?
Absolutely.
Hugely important.
In what sense?
I think, you know, like being women of colour, we don't often get a stage to perform what we're doing. And especially in the sectors that we're in. So in literature for Nikita and in music production, you don't often see women of colour. And the fact that we've come together with this very powerful and really emotive piece, I think is really like important.
I'm looking at you, Nali. You've got this. What have you got in front of you? You describe it.
So it's called a Machina. It's by Native Instruments, and it's basically a drum machine. So I can program in any sounds that I want.
It's like you would never know that was a drum machine, though, if you didn't know it was a drum machine, because it's just got little pads on it, right?
Yeah. So
I sound like such an auntie right now, don't I? Like, oh, it's got little pads on it. Describe it.
It's kind of, you know, I've got these 16 pads. Unlimited amount of groups that I can set up in these pads, and then each pad can have an individual sound on it. So it's almost like having an entire band or an orchestra or an entire recording studio at my fingertips.
Okay, will you give us a burst?
Yeah.
Will you impress us? And this is what did, how did I describe it? Two-finger drumming.
Finger drumming.
Finger drumming, all right, here we go. That's so good. And her fingers are going 10 to the dozen. Excellent. I filmed you on my phone so that we can put that on our social media later so everyone can see exactly what's going on. So impressive. I think we now need to hear the two of you perform something. Tell me what you're going to do. And is this what you will be performing at the South Bank?
Yes. So this is called War Song. And it basically is about, again, like we spoke about female rage, and it's like a little taster from the middle of the show. So,
okay. So this is Nikita Gill and Nali. Take it away.
A war song for the women who have lost so many selves, they fight back, who are called monsters because when the world tries to harm them, they turn into switchblades and fight back. It happens at a party, it happens at a market, it happens at a church, a temple, a gurdwara. It happens when we are walking home or at school or at work. The point is not that it happens to the best of us or the worst of us. The point is it happens to most of us. And there is only so many times you can turn someone into prey before they do what any good wolf does and strike back.
It happened to me at a club at 18, where I finally went from girl to monster, where I found that I had it in me to lash out at the greedy hands that were trying to take from my body what I never agreed to give. I lashed out in a way I didn't even know was within me. Fangs instead of teeth. A red glow in my bones. A siren song in my sinews as I bit and scratched and punched till I was left alone. Women are taught to be silent. Women are taught to take injustice, turn it into healing or perhaps something pretty, but never fight back with such ferocity. Later, I looked at my hands and asked myself, what happens to prey when it fights back? Am I a predator now? And this was when the goddess came back to me to give me her story. She told me, there is only one goddess named Carnage. One goddess who has distilled anger in woman form and who causes such fear that they have misplaced her story of origin. There are three versions. In one tale, I was born terrifying. On the battlefields where gods fought demons and no one wanted to make the demons bleed, because what good are gods without their piety? So instead, I was conjured from the goddess Durga's head, bloodthirsty and angry. In the second, I was born from the ashes, when Shiva tricked the Mahadevi, goddess mother to us all, and made her give him her powers. And from the ashes, I was born. Women do this. We are able to resurrect ourselves from the ashes of what others do to us. In the third, I was born to be every mother's uncontrollable rage from the womb of the goddess of love, a riot in a woman's body when she found her beheaded son, Lord Ganesh. I waged war on this earth, poured destruction into everything that existed here. I was the vengeance the gods could not silence. No matter how hard they tried, they had to beg and plead to ask that I put my anger aside. All three are true. All three are not true. It doesn't matter. People lie all the time to each other. Lies become rumors, and rumors become legends, and legends turn into myths, and gods and goddesses are born. It's why we reincarnate so often, to tell a different story. What doesn't change is our purpose. I was born to drain the wicked from the earth. They cannot change that about me. Even when they tried to rename me demonic, they cannot change that I am also woman, friend, protector, mother and sister to all the women who worship me. They will tell you, I am not beautiful. I agree. I was never meant to be. I am chaos. I am the rage they quiver before. I carry within me an anger so powerful, even the gods are afraid of me. Even in power, they want us to be pretty. They expect us to be palatable, easy to digest, as though we are some small feast. But dear one, I am proof we do not have to be. We can be a war cry and a violence. We can be ugly as we want to be. Hard to swallow, unsettling to look at, a fire in the mind, a morbid they fear. What happened to you is one of many tragedies too many women go through, but this does not have to define you. You too can be like me. I am a goddess of duality. Sometimes I sit on a throne of corpses, and sometimes the gods themselves hold up my throne. I challenge their sense of what is womanly, wear my hair untamed, the patroness goddess of destruction and anger and righteous fury. Whatever I am, they find it hard to accept me. I am a dialogue between what is carnal and what is glory. Monster maiden, mighty and mythical story. Let yourself be like me and become an enigma too. But here's the trick, dear one. When you embrace your monster, you must turn your anger into a spell. If wielded with wisdom, it'll serve you well. And if they ask you who gave you permission to your rage, you tell them, the rage is a gift the goddess Kali gave you.
Oh wow. Nikita Nali, thank you so much for that live performance. They'll be performing tonight at the Purcell Room, South Bank Centre, and next Friday, the 8th. thanking you, but you've heard it here first on Woman's Hour. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. Oh, my unwaxed arm hairs are standing on end. Now, thank you both. Now, we're talking friendships on Woman's Hour today, but a certain kind of friendship, one with someone from a different generation to you. Are you mates with someone who is much older or much younger than you? And what makes this friendship special? What do you talk about? Are you in one? Get in touch. I'd love to hear from you. 84844. Sue and Emily are best friends from Kent. They've got a 27-year age gap. Sue is 60 and Emily is 33. And they join us now. Morning to you both.
Good morning.
Emily, how did you become friends? Where did you meet?
So we both belong to the same running club. And we went on an away marathon together with a group of people from the running club. And we just really hit it off. I've just been friends ever since. I think that was about 6 years ago.
Sue, you have daughters the same age as Emily, and Sue is probably the same age as your mum. Is it comparable to the mother-daughter relationship? Is it similar? What do you think, Sue?
No, it is very different. It is with a mother, you tend to be much more nurturing. It's much more about guidance, and you know, like if Emily's saying something because she's got children as well, and she's saying, "Oh, I need a bit of help on something." It's much more about sort of advice and suggestions, whereas with your own children it's a bit more guidance, a bit more nurturing. I mean it's much more fun, like a friendship, whereas with a parent you have that responsibility all the time and you're very concerned that you're doing the right thing and you're not saying things that in any way could harm them, whereas with a friend that sort of responsibility as a person, as a nurturing parent, isn't really there, which is great.
You can talk about anything and not be awkward. We're getting lots of people getting in touch about this, you know. Amanda says, as a 63-year-old woman, I can honestly say that some of the most rewarding friendships have been with younger men and women in their 20s. They consider me to be a wise woman and listen carefully to my opinions. I hope I do likewise. And I can honestly say that I think the generation gap has disappeared. Is that what's happened with you, do you think? That actually, there is no joke that the wisdom that you learn from each other is important.
Yeah, definitely. I generally just feel like Sue is just one of my friends. It's not, the age gap has got nothing to do with it. It's just we really hit it off. We find each other really funny. We've got the same sense of humour, and there's just that openness there that you get with any friendship.
How is it different, though, to the relationships and friendships that you have with people your own age?
Well, I think when people my own age tend to be look back on life a little bit. It tends to be a bit more jaded, a little bit more, this is what's happened to me in the past, particularly talk about relationships or careers or whatever, it tends to be always looking back, whereas Emily's always looking forward, and younger people tend to be always saying they've got these experiences to come yet, and some of them we've gone through and some of them we haven't. I feel when I'm talking to Emily exactly the same age as her, so although I do realize I'm older than her, I'm not you know stupid but I don't feel that when I'm talking to her. I feel we are feeling the same things about the same as you do with your friends. But then sometimes, like, she's got young children and my children are grown up, and you then feel sometimes she'll be, you know, concerned about something. You feel you have to then offer advice because you've been there and done it. Emily's into women in sport. It's a big issue for her. You know, she's very trying to promote it massively. And so she's talking much more from me, the younger perspective, and I will be then.
But that's probably, it's really interesting though, isn't it, to hear the younger perspective. Life has changed quite a lot in the last sort of, you know, 30 years and sort of different perspectives. What do you think, Emily?
Definitely. I feel like from my point of view, I've got my friends, I've got my really close group of girlfriends that I went to school with at the same age as me. We feel like we're all in it together. We've got the same struggles. We've got young kids, we're married, we have the same kind of issues. Sue's been through a lot of that, and so for me it's having that person who has seen a lot more of life than I have and has just been through all these things, kids and marriage and all sorts of stuff, and being able to go to that person and have that other perspective that comes in. And for Sue to say to me, you know, don't worry about X, Y and Z, you need to be looking at the bigger picture and looking at this. And for me, it's just having that person that can go, you know, forget all the stuff that you're annoyed about today. You know, you've got all these fantastic things going on.
Do you know, it's interesting because obviously we knew we were setting this, going to be talking to the two of you. And I was thinking about it last night and I thought, why wouldn't we want friends from different generations? This idea that you only hang out with people your own age is probably the the odd thing, really, surely, where you'd want to talk to people with from different walks of life with different experiences.
Yeah, I remember leaving university and being desperate to go to work where there would be a range of ages.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're university, you're just with the same age all the time. But I do actually remember that. And I love it. I think it brings such a whole range to, you know, to the workplace, to what you're talking about, you know, people at different stages, different experiences, different emotions.
And you've obviously got the running club in common, but where else do you hang out? Like if you were my mate, Sue, I might want to take you to a club. Would you come with me?
Well, I would actually. Yeah.
Good on you. Yeah, why not?
I don't know. I think it's about just getting out there and doing things and being spontaneous. And I think that's a personality thing. I think that's the thing about Emily and I. We get on, and it's about personalities. And neither of us are ageist in the sense that, particularly from Emily's point of view, I don't feel that she talks to me differently because of my age. I think she just talks to me because I am who I am, and we get on.
Yeah.
And it's like we have the same sense of humour. We're quite rude to each other all the time. So we never fall out because we don't know if we're actually being rude or funny. You know?
Emily, what's the best thing about your friendship with Sue?
I think, like I said before, it's just having that older perspective. But genuinely, she's just a really, really good mate. Like it's not in any way, you know, I'm not trying to do myself any favours by having a range of different friendships. It's just, we genuinely really get on. She's just a really good friend, someone I can confide in with stuff. You know, we talk about everything. There's nothing that's off limits or anything, you know.
And have you met each other's friends? Have you hung out with each other's friendship groups?
Emily's wedding. It was good, you know, at her wedding I sat next to her, and it was, yeah, there were some really good people there. And then I said recently Emily's done a presentation of women in sport, and it was a whole range, and she's been out for coffee with my daughters as well and things like that. Yes, it's fine, you know.
We've had a lovely text in here saying, I'm 31 and have a lovely friend of 95. We've known each other since I was 12. I know, that's a great gap, isn't it? We've known each other since I was 12, and our chats have progressed from just J20s and biscuits, I love those, to cocktails and cake. Her perspective on life is wonderful. She gives me advice, but also asks my opinion on modern day issues that she wants to understand. I get so much from our friendship and always come away from time with her feeling inspired. How lovely is that?
Yeah,
phenomenal. That's what friendship's all about, isn't it? It's about putting energy, positive energy, into each other. I don't think the age makes a difference at all, really. It just adds a different perspective to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe it's highly recommended. Go out there and find friends from a different generation.
Yeah, absolutely. Be out there.
Get out there. Thank you so much for speaking to me, Sue and Emily. 84844 is the number to text. Someone else said it's important to have friendships from different backgrounds to learn and grow personally. We're all human, and it's important to interact. Indeed it is. Now, writer and broadcaster Liz Fraser has written a memoir about being in a relationship with a man she loves, the father of her child, who is also an alcoholic. For a time, she failed to realise that he had an addiction, let alone how serious it was. And she also kept the often shocking truth of what was going on entirely to herself, trying in vain to help her partner find a path to sobriety. Finally, she started to speak about it. The book is Coming Clean, a true story of love, addiction and recovery. And it came out yesterday. And Liz joins me in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, the events you described in the book happened so recently. Mm. What made you choose to write and publish it so quickly?
They did happen very recently. And I suppose with addiction and recovery, it's going to be forever, actually, this story for us. In a way, I didn't decide to write it at a particular time. I wrote it because I needed to start writing this stuff down, really, for myself to make any sense of what had happened. I wrote the book throughout lockdown. So I started writing it in about March, I suppose, March, April of the first lockdown that we had. And it helped me to put in any sort of order, in any way that I could really understand at last what had actually happened. And it's funny that you say that, you know, it was so recent. It's very raw. Mm. my editor said to me recently, you know, Liz, I remember your first draft coming in and it was just blistering pain, trauma, rage. And then seeing the next draft come in as you'd given it 6 months, how you change. And she said, it's like literally like reading somebody living through this. And it is. And it's not just me and my story. And I think that's very important to say. My partner gave me not only his blessing to write this book, but he when he was 6 months or so into his sobriety, he reached this beautiful sort of sweet spot of suddenly being able to see what had happened to me. And I think that was also through the meetings that he was going to and listening to other accounts of other people. And I remember he came home one day from a meeting and said, Liz, you have to write this. I want you to write this, because I couldn't be aware at the time of what I was doing to you and what you went through. And there are so many people in your position, and you almost owe it to, you know, to those people to write this down, because I needed so much help, and I didn't know what was going on, as happens to so many people. So I've written it down in case it helps anyone else.
You said it yourself. It's raw. Mm. I would say it's unflinching. It's incredibly brave, and you are drawn to every page because you want to know what is going to happen, because you
so
are,
did I.
Yeah. Well, we're living it yeah. with you.
Yeah. I'm glad that you say that. I really am. I mean,
you fell in love and started to live together quite quickly, didn't you? But he already had the addiction, but you just didn't know about it.
I don't know whether he had an addiction or whether, you see, the thing with addiction and with mental health problems is they're often multifactorial. So you're very rarely just an alcoholic. There's probably an underlying, at least one other condition, be it anxiety, depression, it might be ADHD, that there are many other factors usually. And the drinking very often starts as a buffer for that, you know, something to dampen these feelings of heightened anxiety or of depression. And unfortunately, with addiction, it just takes over. And it is the most selfish thing in the world. And you, the partner, you might not recognise any of the signs, and that's something really important to talk about, I think, today. And also, it might take you a very long time to realise that there is absolutely nothing you can do. You are fighting something that is so much greater than you. And whatever you do, and however much you try, you suffer, you give, you hope, you shout, you scream, you whatever is not even left of you in the end, you have no chance against something as huge as addiction, and it will destroy you. The only person who can deal with it or yeah. come, you know, manage it is the person who suffers from it.
So what were the signs that you didn't know to look out for? Because you do, you know, you write about it very early on in the relationship. It was one of your first dates that he passed out.
Oh, that wasn't a date, actually. That wasn't the first date. That was just the first time we hung out together. And yeah, look, I don't know if I come from an especially sheltered background. I do come from quite a sheltered background. I could admit that. But what I'm hearing from a lot of other people now, especially, I mean, the Coming Clean came out yesterday, and it landed on a lot of people's doormats yesterday. And I've been inundated by messages from people saying, my God, you are saying every single thing that I felt. And a lot of us don't know, right? What are the signs? They're often very small. It's little inconsistencies. It's things that don't quite make sense. And then it turns into lies and lies and lies. He would sort of disappear and then not come back on time. And there was always a ready reason. There was a reason. And you know, the trouble is, we live in an alcohol-soaked culture, right? So it's not weird for someone to get super drunk at a stag do or whatever it would be. But it was somehow different. And I always excused it. And I always said, oh, you know, it's because he's tired, or it's because he's injured, or it's... And then there would be the way he would pass out was so odd, or fall asleep. Like nothing, 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 nothing. Lucid, fine, absolutely fine, functioning, out cold. And would wake up the next morning and go, yeah, sorry, I guess I was tired, you know. And even then I didn't realise that was odd. And then it started to build. After I had our baby, who's now 3.5, there was sort of more frequent, the disappearances were ever more. And then it's only in retrospect, as I started to write the book, that you can look back and go, all these extra hours you were working, all this extra, the money never, I never saw the money. I just didn't see it. And one of the things I think is very difficult for partners or families of addicts to deal with is how angry you can feel with yourself and how stupid you feel. And I felt really, really stupid to have not only not noticed all of this stuff, but what it obviously was, but also that I continued to enable it and let it happen because I'm empathetic and I'm a mother and I'm a pleaser. And
you loved him.
Exactly. I thought it would be okay. But I loved him so absolutely. It was just not possible to me that this thing was going to come between us, you know.
There's so much I want to talk to you about, Liz, because the book is just, I mean, you moved to Venice together. And that was really where it started. It spiraled, didn't it? You're with a 10-month-old.
Yeah. And this is something I think that I've learned from, I have a large network now of friends who are addicts of one kind or another, generally now sober or clean. And one of the things that I've heard so often from them is that the only constant in addiction is change and reinvention, because there's a hole in the soul. There's this hole in this person and they try and fix it, or, you know, fill it with this. I'll set up a business. I'll, you know, have a baby. I'll start doing this. I'll become a vegan. I'll do a triathlon. It's an obsession of something else, something else. And the move to Venice, right, it was not crazy. It was not crazy. It was, we went there when I was pregnant and we were very happy there. And he said, you know what, I love it here. I actually think I could be really happy here. The light and the sea, I'm a photographer, it'd be great. There was lots of work for me as a copywriter, translator. There was plenty of work to be found for him. And we went. So it wasn't like this crazy on a whim, hey, let's go to Venice. If anyone listening has ever been to Venice, you will know that it's a floating pub and it is absolutely soaked with booze. There's no paper trail because you pay in cash. You can disappear down all these, you know, you can be 20 minutes late because, in fact, it's impossible to stay on time. So it descended very, very, very quickly.
Yeah, and it gets to, it's really, you describe the descent and we are living it with you. That's the best way I can describe it. When you read the book, you'll see for yourself. But one thing that stood out for me is that you said that actually you realised during that time in Venice, how important your girlfriends were. The support you got from the women around you.
I did, not initially. And I do say in the book, I'm really not a girly girl. And the whole sisterhood thing is something that I've never really been a part of. I've never really, identified with or felt comfortable with. And I think that's common of many women, actually. I have one brother and I tended to have more male friends and I have great male friends. But when he finally really fell off the cliff, which was after a period of 2.5 months of sobriety... And this is the thing with alcoholism. It can happen at 10 o'clock on a Tuesday morning and there doesn't appear to be much reason for it. He was then sort of, drunk enough or unwell enough that he really couldn't function in much of a helpful way or a well way for quite a long time. And I really was on my own with my daughter, who was 18 months at the time. And yes, I did at that point start talking. I ended up travelling with her quite a lot because I couldn't be in Venice. I had nowhere to live in the UK. A friend of mine in Sweden said, hey, come and stay. So I did. But I ended up talking to, you know, women in parks and on trains. And every single time I said, they were like, you know, why are you here on your own? What are you doing? Oh, my partner's an alcoholic. And boom, straight away. Oh, my God, my ex was, my mother was. And it was everywhere. And I just started to think, wow, I had no idea. And the progression of alcoholism, and I think this is a really important thing to say, because Coming Clean is a book not just for partners or families. It's also for alcoholics or people who think they may have a problem. It's a progressive disease. It will only get worse. That's the only way it's going to go is worse. And it reached the point with me where there was not just mental and psychological abuse, but you know, physical, you know, there was violence. And when you find yourself in a situation like that and you are actually threatened very seriously and terrible things happened, you don't really know what to do, because you're looking at the person that you do know, who you knew was lovely and you love, but they've now become so ravaged by this disease that they're actually barely human at this point. And worse still, I became dehumanized. Yeah. So there was nothing he couldn't do or say to me, because I almost didn't exist to him anymore as a person, because he was just filled. I hope what I'm saying is correct. And we have talked about this a lot and it's all in the book.
it becomes dangerous because you're not dealing with a normally functioning person. And then what do you do? That's the thing. What do you do? How many times do you say,
and I'll come back until you decide. And actually, you know, I'll, what's interesting, Liz, is, you know, you had a career, you have a family, you've got teenage children, you know, you're very much a woman in control of your life in your early 40s, and you're unrecognizable even to yourself.
Yeah, it's interesting.
So I'm reading the book, and I'm thinking, why? And I'm sure lots of people have said, it's the obvious question, why not just step away?
Well, this is probably a very good time to start talking about gaslighting and psychological manipulation and control. Because, yes, you're right, you know, on paper and demonstrably, I, like many people listening to this as well, am very capable, competent, smart, you know, successful, sane, very sane. If you spend a lot of time with somebody who tells you you're mad and says, I told you I was coming home late. No, I didn't say that. You know, even if it's things like, even if someone is, you have boundaries and you say, if you swear at me in this house, I'm going to ask you to leave the house. They swear at you. Could you leave the house, please, just for a minute? Oh, are you kicking me out? So you're kicking me out, are you? Mm. No, I'm not kicking you out. I'm saying that's beyond my boundaries. So you want me to go now? And you end up, you're told you're mad. I was told that other people think I'm mad. This still, you know, this continues. I've got people who will testify that you're mad, you're crazy. You see, you start to believe it, or you start to question your own sanity. Maybe I am. And also your own behaviour has now changed to the point that, you know, maybe when someone's being horrendous to you, you break to the point. So I started self-harming. I'm sorry if this is a trigger for anybody, so I won't go into any detail. But can you imagine the distress a human has to be in to seek relief from pain by hurting themselves? And then to be told, you're crazy. Look at you, you're mad. You do that, you shouldn't be near a child, actually. Oh my goodness, your head is just spinning at this point. And when actually you just need love and you need support.
How are you now, and how is the relationship between you now? Because the book came out yesterday. He doesn't come across very well in quite a lot of the book, and you put in a lot of horrible, nasty messages that he sent you, and we learn about the gaslighting. You know, we're living through it. Yeah. But how are things between you now?
But I hope, and this has been a great response, has been how compassionate it is. Any time, in fact, I even say I feel terrible writing some of this stuff because I know this wasn't, you know, he didn't mean to be this way.
Later.
So I do... I'm very clear on that. Well, you ask how we are now. He actually left me about 7 weeks ago tomorrow at 10 to 2 approximately. And this is not the first time. This is the fourth, fifth, sixth, I don't know, time that he's sort of done this. And I respect his decision, of course. And everybody has the right to choose to live how they want to live. It came as an absolute shock to me because I thought we were just about to get things really in order, and lockdown was over, and our daughter's nearly four. But it's this restlessness, and you see it building. Anyone listening who lives with someone in this way, you see the signs. Look, and I saw it, and I tried.
I have to say, for anybody listening though, Liz, AI Anon is available.
Al-Anon
is an organisation for partners of alcoholics. And of course, we will be putting up links to various websites that can support you if you are going through with anything similar to what Liz has been through on our website. Liz, thank you so much for coming in and speaking to me this morning. The book is out now, and it's called Coming Clean, A True Story of Love and Addiction. And thank you to all of you who messaged during the show today. Have a lovely weekend. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
Hello there, I'm Richard Osman. Before you go, yes, I know you've switched off already, but in case you haven't, I want to tell you about my new Radio 4 podcast, The Birthday Cake Game, a brand new comedy quiz that poses one simple question. Do you know how old people are? By which I mean, how old, say, is Bruce Willis? Now, I know all you're doing now is thinking about how old Bruce Willis is and not listening to me, but I can tell you, each episode I'm joined by three celebrity guests who battle against each other to see how old celebrities are that week. Richard Gere.
I'm still enjoying the assertion that Richard Gere has always been old.
Yeah. What a beautiful baby, Mrs. Gere. And unusual grey hair.
That's so old, your baby.
The winner takes home a birthday cake, a very special birthday cake from a supermarket I can't mention, in the shape of an insect I can't mention. You know the one I'm talking about. So tune in to find out who comes on top and see if you can beat the players and score higher at home. That's The Birthday Cake Game. Listen and subscribe right now on BBC Sounds. How old is Bruce Willis?
What is wellness?
I think of the image of wellness as like pure joy.
The important thing is for people to choose, like, what do you want to do?
Wellness are the things your grandmother told you to do.
When you really start to think about it, the answer feels more complicated. I'm Maya Feller, registered dietitian nutritionist and author.
And I'm Dr. Kavita Patel. We're the hosts of Well Now, Slate's new podcast on wellness.
Join us every Wednesday as we tackle that simple yet important question, what does it mean to be well?